A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Welcome to My Weird Prompts, episode 2211. Daniel sent us this one, and it's one of those questions that seems almost too obvious until you actually stop and think about it. A newborn sleeps 16 to 18 hours a day. Most adults are lucky to get 7. Why does the same brain demand such wildly different sleep budgets at different ages? And why does it all eventually stabilize around that magic number of 8 hours? The answer, it turns out, is not just growing takes energy. It's about fundamentally different brain architectures, metabolic priorities, and a negotiation between biology and culture that's still unfolding in labs right now.
The thing that grabbed me immediately is that this isn't really a question about sleep duration at all. It's about sleep architecture, what the brain is actually doing during those hours. A baby sleeping 18 hours isn't just an adult sleeping 18 hours in miniature. The composition is completely different. You've got REM dominance, radically different metabolic demands, and a brain that is quite literally wiring itself in real time.
The real question is what that wiring project demands and why the brain eventually decides it can get the job done in a single consolidated block instead of the polyphasic chaos of infancy.
Let's start with what's happening inside an infant brain, because the numbers are genuinely staggering. In the first year of life, the human brain produces about 40,000 new synapses per second. Per second, corn. That's not a typo. By age 2, a toddler's brain has roughly twice as many synaptic connections as an adult brain.
Which sounds inefficient until you realize the overproduction is the point.
It's absolutely the point. The brain's strategy is to massively overproduce connections and then selectively eliminate the ones that aren't useful. This is the synaptic pruning hypothesis, and it's one of the central explanations for why infants need so much sleep. The pruning doesn't happen randomly, it happens during sleep, and specifically during REM sleep.
REM is the brain's spring cleaning crew.
During REM, the brain is essentially tagging which connections to keep and which to eliminate. Think of it like a massive library that receives 40,000 new books every second. At some point, you need a librarian to come through and say, this one's a duplicate, this one's never been checked out, this one belongs in the fiction section, not the science section. That librarian is REM sleep.
The librarian works a lot of overtime in the first year. What's the actual REM proportion in newborns?
Newborns spend about 50% of their total sleep time in REM. Compare that to adults, where REM accounts for about 20 to 25%. So an infant isn't just sleeping more hours, they're getting a dramatically higher proportion of the kind of sleep that does the neural wiring work. If an adult sleeps 8 hours with roughly 2 hours of REM, a newborn sleeping 16 hours is getting 8 hours of REM, 4 times the REM exposure.
That's a lot of librarian shifts, and there's a concrete example of what happens when that gets disrupted, right? The NICU data?
Yes, and this is where it stops being abstract and gets clinically significant. There was a 2023 study in JAMA Pediatrics that looked at preterm infants in neonatal intensive care units. These are babies whose sleep is constantly disrupted by medical interventions, alarms, lights. The researchers found that for every 10% reduction in REM sleep during the first 6 months, there was a 4-point drop in Bayley 3 cognitive scores at age 2. 4 points on a standardized developmental assessment scale is meaningful. That's the difference between average and below average.
The stakes are real. This isn't just interesting neuroscience. Disrupted REM in infancy has measurable cognitive consequences years later.
It's not just global cognitive development. REM is doing specific wiring jobs. The visual cortex is a classic example. For binocular vision to develop properly, the ability to fuse input from both eyes into a single depth-perceiving image, you need REM sleep to consolidate the neural circuits that coordinate the two eyes. If you block REM in critical periods of visual development, those circuits don't form correctly. This has been demonstrated in animal models going back decades, but the human data from NICU populations reinforces it.
We've got the synaptic pruning story and the sensory wiring story. But you also mentioned metabolic demands. What's the energy angle?
This is the part that I think gets overlooked in most popular science coverage. The infant brain is an energy hog of almost unbelievable proportions. In adults, the brain consumes about 20% of the body's total energy, which is already disproportionate given that it's only 2% of body mass. In infants, the brain consumes 60% of the body's total energy. That means more than half of every calorie a baby takes in goes straight to the brain.
That's like running a data center off a household electrical panel. Something's going to trip the breaker.
That's where sleep comes in. During sleep, cerebral glucose metabolism drops by 25 to 40%. Sleep is the brain's power-saving mode. For an infant brain burning 60% of the body's energy budget, those metabolic breaks aren't optional. They're essential to prevent what you might call metabolic exhaustion. The brain simply cannot sustain that level of construction activity continuously. It needs downtime to clear waste, rebalance neurotransmitter levels, and manage its energy reserves.
The sleep isn't just for wiring. It's also thermal management, essentially, preventing the system from overheating.
And there's a fascinating molecular mechanism that ties this together. A 2024 paper in Nature Neuroscience by Sao and colleagues identified a protein called NPAS4. This protein accumulates in the brain during wakefulness, and when it reaches a certain threshold, it triggers sleep onset. It's basically a molecular sleep pressure gauge. The key finding for our discussion is that in infant mice, and the mechanism appears to be conserved in humans, this threshold is significantly lower. Infants hit the must-sleep threshold faster because their NPAS4 accumulation rate outpaces their clearance capacity.
It's not just that babies are tired because they're doing a lot. They're literally calibrated to hit the sleep wall sooner. The biological tripwire is set lower.
And this connects to another question people often ask. Why don't babies just consolidate all that sleep into one long block? Why the polyphasic pattern of sleeping and waking every few hours?
I assume part of it is the obvious one. Small stomach. Need to feed frequently.
That's part of it, definitely. A newborn stomach is roughly the size of a marble at birth, and only expands to about the size of an egg by day 10. They physically can't take in enough calories to sustain a long fast. But there's a neurological reason, too. The glymphatic system, this is the brain's waste clearance apparatus, isn't fully developed at birth. In adults, the glymphatic system clears metabolic waste products like beta amyloid and tau proteins most efficiently during slow-wave sleep, and it does so in long, consolidated cycles. The infant glymphatic system is immature and clears waste in shorter, more frequent bursts. So the polyphasic sleep pattern matches the clearance capacity.
The brain dishwasher runs smaller loads because the plumbing can't handle a full cycle yet.
That's a perfect analogy. The infant brain's dishwasher runs more frequent, shorter cycles. The adult brain runs one big overnight cycle. And that transition, from polyphasic to monophasic, from REM dominant to slow wave dominant, from 16 hours to 8, is what we need to unpack next.
We've seen why infant brains are REM factories. Synaptic pruning, sensory wiring, metabolic management, all running on shorter cycles because the hardware is still being built. But when does this frantic neural construction project wind down? And why does sleep eventually consolidate into that familiar 8-hour block?
The trajectory is actually pretty well mapped. From 16 to 18 hours at birth, you drop to about 12 to 14 hours by age 1, 10 to 12 hours by age 5, 9 to 10 hours by age 10, and then roughly 8 to 9 hours by age 18. But the steepest drop happens between ages 2 and 5. That's the period when synaptic pruning is at its most aggressive, and the brain is transitioning from the overproduction phase to the refinement phase.
This maps onto what we know about early childhood development generally. The explosion of language, theory of mind, motor coordination, all of that is happening in the 2-5 window.
And the brain is making a strategic shift. In infancy, the priority is generating possibilities, creating as many connections as possible so that experience can select the useful ones. By age 2-5, the priority shifts to efficiency. The brain starts pruning aggressively, eliminating redundant connections, and myelinating the pathways that remain. Myelination is the process of insulating neural axons with a fatty sheath, and it dramatically increases signal transmission speed. A myelinated axon conducts signals up to 100 times faster than an unmyelinated one.
The brain is trading plasticity for speed. Fewer connections, but the ones that remain are faster and more reliable.
This trade-off directly affects sleep architecture. As myelination proceeds and synaptic density drops, the brain simply doesn't need as much REM for the tagging and pruning process. REM proportion drops from 50% at birth to about 30% by age 2, and then gradually down to the adult level of 20 to 25% by late adolescence.
Then puberty throws a grenade into the whole system.
Oh, it completely does. The circadian shift at puberty is one of the most robust findings in sleep science, and it's biological, not social. During puberty, the onset of melatonin secretion, that's the hormone that signals the brain to prepare for sleep, delays by 2 to 3 hours. A prepubescent child might naturally feel sleepy at 8 or 9 p.m. A 15-year-old, same biology, same environment, won't feel that sleep pressure until 10 or 11 p.m.
Every parent of a teenager just nodded in recognition.
Here's the thing. There was a 2025 longitudinal study from the University of Surrey that tracked 1,200 adolescents and found this shift occurs regardless of screen time. Now, screen time can exacerbate it. Blue light exposure in the evening can push the delay even further, but the core shift is hormonal. It's driven by changes in the hypothalamic-pituitary-gonadal axis. The same hormones that drive physical maturation also rewire the circadian clock.
The teenager who can't fall asleep before midnight and can't wake up before 10 isn't being lazy or undisciplined. Their biology has literally shifted their sleep phase.
This is where the mismatch with social schedules becomes a real problem. High schools that start at 7:30 a.m. are forcing adolescents to function during what is, biologically, the tail end of their sleep phase. It's the equivalent of asking an adult to start work at 3 a.m. every day. The cognitive impairment is comparable to being mildly intoxicated.
There's been a push to move school start times later. Has that actually happened anywhere?
California mandated later start times for middle and high schools back in 2019. 8 a.m. for middle schools, 8:30 for high schools. The early data showed reduced tardiness and improved academic performance, though implementation has been uneven. But the biological reality is clear regardless of policy. The adolescent brain is on a delayed schedule and fighting it has real cognitive costs.
Let's tie this back to the core question. We've got the sleep duration dropping from 16 hours to about 8 by age 18. We've got the architecture shifting from REM dominant to slow wave dominant. We've got the circadian clock being hormonally delayed during adolescence. What actually stabilizes at 8 hours? Is 8 the biological set point, or is it just where cultural expectations happen to land?
This is the misconception I really want to bust. 8 hours is not a biological universal. It's a cultural norm that roughly aligns with the equilibrium point of what's called the two-process model of sleep, but the range of healthy human sleep duration is wider than most people think.
Walk me through the two-process model.
It's the dominant framework in sleep science, and it's elegantly simple. Process S is sleep pressure. It builds up during wakefulness, driven by adenosine accumulation in the brain. The longer you're awake, the more adenosine builds up, the sleepier you feel. Process C is circadian alerting. It's your internal clock's wakefulness signal, which rises and falls on a roughly 24-hour cycle. Sleep happens when process S is high and process C is low. You wake up when process S has been dissipated by sleep and process C is rising again.
It's a negotiation between how long you've been awake and what time your internal clock thinks it is.
And the 8-hour norm emerges because, in most adults, it takes about 16 hours of wakefulness for process S to build enough pressure to overcome the circadian alerting signal and about 8 hours of sleep to dissipate that pressure back to baseline. But, and this is crucial, the rate of adenosine accumulation changes with age. Infants accumulate adenosine roughly twice as fast as adults, which is why they hit the sleep threshold after being awake for only an hour or two. By late adolescence, the adenosine clearance system has matured, and the accumulation rate stabilizes at the adult level.
The 8 hours isn't a hardwired number. It's the result of a particular adenosine accumulation rate crossing a particular circadian threshold. Change either variable and the optimum shifts.
We see this variation in the real world. Hunter-gatherer groups like the Hadza and San people average 6.5 to 7 hours of sleep per night. These are populations without artificial lighting, without fixed work schedules, sleeping in natural environmental conditions. If 8 hours were a biological imperative, you'd expect them to hit it. They don't. They sleep less than the industrialized norm, and they show no signs of cognitive impairment or health consequences from the shorter duration.
Which suggests the 8-hour number is at least partly an artifact of artificial lighting and industrial schedules.
There was a fascinating experiment by Thomas Vare in 1992 that demonstrated this directly. He put participants in a 14-hour dark period every night, simulating winter light conditions before electricity. No artificial light, no alarms, just natural sleep. Within a few weeks, their sleep consolidated into a biphasic pattern. They'd sleep for about 4 hours, wake for an hour or two of quiet restfulness, and then sleep for another 4 hours. Total sleep was still about 8 hours, but it wasn't one continuous block.
The monophasic 8-hour block is a modern artifact, but the total duration might actually reflect something real.
That's the synthesis. The monophasic pattern, one consolidated sleep block, is culturally reinforced by artificial lighting and work schedules. But the total sleep need, the amount of sleep required to fully dissipate process S and complete the necessary sleep cycles, does seem to converge around 7 to 9 hours for most adults. It's not that 8 hours is wrong, it's that it's a rough average with significant individual variation, not a biological law.
The glymphatic system plays into this too, right? You mentioned earlier that splitting sleep into 2 4-hour blocks reduces clearance efficiency.
Yes. And this is where the consolidation actually matters for health. A 2024 MIT study looked at glymphatic clearance efficiency under different sleep patterns. They found that splitting sleep into 2 4-hour blocks reduced clearance efficiency by 30% compared to one consolidated 8-hour block. The glymphatic system needs long, uninterrupted, slow-wave sleep cycles to pump cerebrospinal fluid through the brain and clear out metabolic waste. Beta amyloid, tau proteins, all the gunk that accumulates during wakefulness. The clearance mechanism works best in sustained slow-wave sleep.
We've traded the biphasic pattern for the monophasic one, and that trade has actually improved waste clearance. Industrialization accidentally optimized brain janitorial services.
That's a very corny way to put it, but yes, essentially. The monophasic sleep pattern that emerged from industrialization happens to align well with how the adult glymphatic system operates. Whether that's a happy accident or a case of cultural evolution, selecting for what works biologically is an open question.
Before we leave the comparative angle, you mentioned dolphins earlier. What's going on with animals that sleep dramatically less than we do?
The comparison that always blows my mind is blue whales. They sleep about 2 hours per day in 10-minute micronaps. Their brain is roughly 5 times larger than a human brain, but their synaptic density is significantly lower. They don't have the same pruning load. They don't need the same amount of REM because their neural architecture is less densely interconnected relative to brain volume.
It's not brain size that determines sleep need. It's synaptic density and the amount of neural housekeeping required.
And this is also why dolphin calves are interesting. They sleep with one hemisphere at a time from birth, unihemispheric sleep. They never experience bilateral REM. Their brain maturation timeline is compressed compared to humans. Cetaceans reach adult brain size in 3 to 4 years versus 20 plus years in humans. The compression is possible partly because they don't do the same massive synaptic overproduction and pruning cycle that humans do. Different evolutionary strategy, different sleep architecture.
Humans are on the extreme end of the sleep investment spectrum because we're on the extreme end of the neuroplasticity spectrum. Our brains are born profoundly unfinished, and the sleep is the construction crew working triple shifts to finish the job.
That's the core insight. Human infants are born with brains that are about 25% of adult volume. Compare that to chimpanzees, whose infants are born with brains about 40% of adult volume. Humans have evolved to give birth to neurologically premature infants because our big brains combined with our narrow birth canals. The obstetric dilemma mean we have to finish neural development outside the womb, and that external development is enormously sleep dependent.
Which brings us to the practical question. For parents listening to this, what actually matters? What should they take away from all this neurobiology?
The most important takeaway is that REM sleep in the first year is precious. It's not just rest. It's a proxy for brain plasticity, for the neural construction work that's happening. The 2025 AAP guidelines now recommend responsive sleep practices over cry-it-out methods for the first 6 months. This is a shift from previous guidance, and it's driven by exactly the kind of data we've been discussing. The understanding that extended crying can suppress REM cycles that are critical for neurodevelopment.
To be clear, this isn't about judging parents who used Cry It Out. Parenting is hard, sleep deprivation is a form of torture, and everyone is doing their best. But the science is pointing toward responsiveness being biologically important in those early months.
But the mechanism matters. When a baby is left to cry for extended periods, cortisol levels spike, and elevated cortisol suppresses REM sleep. If REM is when the brain is doing its synaptic tagging and pruning, suppressing it unnecessarily carries potential cognitive costs. The NICU data we discussed earlier, the 4-point drop in cognitive scores with each 10% REM reduction, that's in a medical setting, not a parenting one, but the underlying biology is the same.
What's the actionable takeaway if you're sleeping 8 hours but still waking up exhausted?
Then the issue isn't duration, it's architecture. You might be getting 8 hours of sleep, but insufficient slow-wave sleep, which is when the glymphatic system does its deep cleaning and when growth hormone is released for tissue repair. The two biggest killers of slow-wave sleep are alcohol and a warm sleeping environment. Alcohol fragments sleep architecture. You might fall asleep faster, but you get less slow-wave sleep and less REM. And your core body temperature needs to drop by about 1 to 2 degrees Celsius for optimal slow-wave sleep. A cool bedroom around 65 degrees Fahrenheit or 18 Celsius is ideal.
The nightcap before bed is actually sabotaging the sleep you're trying to get.
It's one of the great ironies. People use alcohol as a sleep aid, and it does reduce sleep onset latency. You fall asleep faster, but the sleep you get is shallower, more fragmented, and less restorative. You're trading quantity for quality, and quality is what matters.
For shift workers, what does the adolescent circadian biology tell us about managing unnatural sleep schedules?
The adolescent data reveals something important about circadian flexibility. It's biologically easier to delay your sleep schedule than to advance it. Going to bed later and waking up later, phase delay, aligns with the natural tendency of the human circadian clock, which actually runs slightly longer than 24 hours in most people. Going to bed earlier and waking up earlier, phase advance, is much harder. For shift workers, this means rotating shifts should move forward, not backward. Day shift to evening shift to night shift, not the reverse.
Forward rotation follows the body's natural tendency. Backward rotation fights it.
And the practical consequence is that forward rotating shift schedules result in better sleep quality, fewer accidents, and lower rates of cardiovascular disease compared to backward rotating schedules. This is well established in occupational health research, but still not universally implemented.
We've covered the infant brain as REM factory, the metabolic tightrope, the adolescent circadian delay, and the stabilization around 8 hours as a negotiation between biology and culture. What's the big open question here? Where is this research heading?
The most ambitious project right now is the Sleep Home Project, which launched earlier this year. It's a longitudinal study tracking sleep architecture from birth to age 25 using wearable EEG devices. For the first time, we'll have continuous, high-resolution data on how sleep architecture changes across the entire developmental trajectory, not just snapshots at different ages. This could finally answer the question of how much sleep is truly enough at each developmental stage and what the individual variation looks like.
The pharmacological angle. We're starting to see drugs that can modulate sleep pressure directly.
Orexin agonists are the big one. Orexin is a neural peptide that promotes wakefulness. In narcolepsy, orexin-producing neurons are destroyed, leading to excessive daytime sleepiness. New orexin agonists can restore wakefulness in narcolepsy patients. But the flip side is also being explored, orexin antagonists that promote sleep. The question is, if we can artificially modulate sleep pressure, could we compress the infant sleep phase? Could we reduce the amount of sleep a developing brain needs without compromising the wiring?
Should we, even if we could?
That's the ethical question. The infant sleep phase isn't just downtime, it's a critical period for neural development. The synaptic pruning, the myelination, the sensory circuit consolidation, all of that takes time, and it's not clear that you can accelerate it without consequences. Evolution has had millions of years to optimize this process. Messing with it pharmaceutically seems like the kind of thing where the knock-on effect could be profound and not immediately visible.
Like trying to speedrun a construction project by cutting the curing time for the concrete. The building might stand up, but you won't know about the structural weaknesses until the earthquake hits.
That's exactly the right analogy. The brain is setting foundations during infant sleep. You don't want to find out at age 40 that the foundation wasn't given enough time to cure.
All right. Before we wrap up, let's make Hilbert do his thing. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the early Renaissance, alchemists studying tidal bore dynamics on the Yukon River would have found that the bore's churning action temporarily elevates dissolved oxygen levels by up to 30%, creating a brief window where the river's chemistry resembles that of a much colder, faster-flowing mountain stream, a phenomenon caused by the turbulent entrainment of atmospheric gases into the water column.
Right, right.
I'm going to spend the rest of the day wondering why Renaissance alchemists were on the Yukon.
They weren't. That's what makes it a Hilbert fact.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping us supplied with facts that raise more questions than they answer. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review. It helps other people find the show. You can find every episode, transcripts, and more at myweirdprompts.com. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. Sleep on it.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.